Welcome to the Talking People podcast. Today, a story, Ogichi Daagweg, the Women's Warrior Society, written by Winona LaDuke. It's a chapter of her book, Last Standing Woman, published by Voyageur Press in 1997. I am recording this story with Winona LaDuke's permission. Ogichi Daagweg, The Women's Warrior Society, 1995. Two matches burned at once, while the oil popped and cracked in the flat setter needles. The flames jumped with each sound, and almost as quickly as they erupted, they died, leaving a glowing edge. Georgette Big Bear pulled the smoke over her head with each of her hands and whispered to the setter. She pulled the smoke over her body and began to turn around. Elaine picked up the eagle feather with her right hand and the small pan with her left. She bathed the feather in smoke and pulled the smoke over Georgette as the older woman turned clockwise. Georgette then helped Elaine pull the smoke around her. Elaine returned to her seat in the northeast of the circle as Georgette continued to smudge each woman in the circle. When finished, she sat down on the east of the circle. Georgette made full moon prayers. She blessed the water and sipped from the bowl. Then she passed it to the left, clockwise. Elaine, the last, completed her prayer and placed the water back in the middle of the circle. As she prayed, the woman listened intently, occasionally punctuating the rhythm of her voice with exclamations of support. This was the third season of the full moon ceremony. It was Quay Dole who brought forth the story at the full moon ceremony in November. She started to talk about Frances Graves, the 11-year-old daughter of one of the tribal councilmen, Fred Graves. "I watched that girl in school, and there is something going on at home," Quaid said. "She cries most days and is gone at least once a week. The truth is, she's got bruises on her too, mostly on her wrists. Or at least, that's all that I can see. It looks like she's trying to cover them up, but she's such a nervous girl that she ends up fidgeting with her sleeves. And then I see those bruises again." Quay looked around. The women were listening. "I found her in the bathroom at the clinic, crying more than a few times. She won't talk to me much, though." A pause. "You all know that her mother is in Minneapolis a lot, and Frances got the job of taking care of those two young boys and cooking for her dad. Everyone knows that her dad has a lot of power, but that is no reason to turn our heads." Then Georgette Big Bear spoke up. She was a guidance counselor at the school. "I talked to her one day in my office. The girl told me that she respects her father a lot and that he's a good man. I asked her if her dad treats her all right, and she just kind of looked down. 'It's hard for him,' the girl mumbled, saying, 'with my ma gone, I sort of take care of all three of them.' I came right out and asked her then," Georgette continued. "I said, 'Does your father touch you in private places?' That girl really looked sad then, but she said, 'No.' The truth was that Fred Graves abused his daughter. It was an awful secret women spoke of in hushed voices, and men pretended did not exist. Graves had been on the tribal council for 3 terms now and had a firmly entrenched base of power. He controlled most of the jobs in his district, and people depended on those jobs for their families. Speaking out meant losing your job. Besides, most people figured the girl seemed okay, and she wasn't the only one who had been through it. Most had survived, and some men actually said that the experience was a rite of passage. As far as the Graves family was concerned, it was said that the father had been abused by his own father, Budu Graves. Fred Graves was passing on the sickness. Georgette did not think abuse was a rite of passage, and neither did Quay or the other women. There had been a suicide a year before. A 14-year-old girl who had been molested by her uncle had blown off her head with a shotgun in a shack behind the house. There were other girls too. For one of them, people said, her grandfather and her father were the same person. The women all listened to the stories and thought about their own lives and experiences. Everyone acknowledged that the sickness existed, but that did not make it right. It was even worse if they let it continue. They prayed, rested, and planned. The rising stick is carved from soft, light cedar and is used to coax the manumin, the wild rice, from its stalks. In the fall, the sound of the sticks hitting against each other and on the rice makes a soothing sound of harvest. This winter night, the sticks would make a different sound. Quay ran her hands over the smoothness of the rising sticks. She was crouched in the dark behind Elaine's war pony, the 1976 Nova. Alongside Quay, there were five others, including Lucy St. Clair, Georgette, Danielle Wabum, and Elaine. In other parked cars along the street, Charlotte, Oshkina, and a few determined elders waited at the ready. Each woman listened to her own breathing as she waited. The sound of an approaching car came through the night. Quay peered over the hood of the Nova and watched Fred Graves park his car in his driveway at 115 Amick Street in the White Earth housing project of Hungry Hill. When he climbed out, Quay could see he was a big man, twice her own size. He took a last drag on the butt of a cigarette, tossed it to the ground, and crushed it out under the toe of his heavy work boot. The girl sat frozen in the front seat. Quay kept her eyes fixed on Francis. The burly man walked around the front of the car and opened the passenger door. "Get out and go inside," he said. She reluctantly emerged and walked toward the house. Her body was mature for an 11-year-old, but she was still a frightened girl. She waited for the man outside the front door. He followed her inside. Lucy shifted her weight from one haunch to another as she braced herself against the cold. Tonight the moon was almost full, one of the coldest nights of the month. It was clear, and she could see the northern lights dancing over the edge of the house. One light appeared in the kitchen and another in the bedroom. Lucy tapped the rising stick against the palm of her hand and waited. Danielle saw the man retrieve two beers from his refrigerator. Paused to open one and take a long drink. He was facing the window, and Danielle swore she could smell the alcohol and the smugness. He flicked off the light and went toward the living room. The television came on to a late-night rerun of Dragnet, and the man sat on the couch, a beer in one hand and glowing cigarette in the other. Maggie watched the girl in her room. The pink walls were covered with posters of rock stars and cartoon characters. A few stuffed toys and knick-knacks were packed against the window on a corner shelf. The girl closed her door and now sat fully clothed on the side of the bed. She carefully removed her shoes and walked to the window, scratching the frost to better look outside. Slowly, she turned and walked back to switch off the light. Still fully clothed, she lay down and pulled her blankets around her. It was 20 minutes later that the living room went dark. The man walked away from the TV, which was still drawing. As he opened the bedroom door, Lucy saw he was clothed only in his shorts. The women were up and running. Maggie made her way toward the girl's bedroom window and carefully placed the small step ladder near the window. She climbed and listened. She could hear the man swearing at the girl and the girl crying as she tried to push him away. Maggie waited a few seconds and then motioned with her arm for the women to move forward. Lucy used a key she had extracted as a favor from an old boyfriend at the housing maintenance office. She put the key into the front door lock and turned the handle. Lucy and the other women slipped inside and moved toward the bedroom, their steps concealed by the monotone of Sergeant Joe Friday on the television. Elaine pushed open the door to the bedroom and flipped on the light switch. Suddenly, the darkness of the room was banished in the glare of the overhead light. Elaine was stunned for a moment at the sight of the man as he tried to force himself inside of the girl. His body was heavy against her as he held her arms down and pushed apart her legs. Her pants were on the floor and his shorts were to his knees. As the light illuminated Elaine's face, the girl looked up at her and shame crossed her young face. The man was too intent to notice until Elaine's rising stick struck him across his back. "Get off her!" Lucy screamed as she rushed into the room and pushed at the man. He looked up and gave a small cry. The women surrounded the girl's bed. The man lifted himself up slightly, and the girl broke free, running from the room. Georgette quickly grabbed her underpants and followed her into the bathroom. As the man attempted to stand, the rising sticks began to fall on his back, head, and butt. He managed a cry and reached to pull his pants up. Danielle grabbed them with her rising stick. "Hoo-ah!" she yelled and yanked them off his legs, twirling them on her rising stick. The women herded him toward the front door, raining down blows and prodding him with the rising sticks. Lucy signaled with a porch light, and as she did so, Charlotte Oshkina, Quay's mom, and another elder, waiting in her cars, switched on the headlights, illuminating the housing project block. "Get moving!" Lucy screamed at him as she kicked the naked man out his front door. The man stumbled toward the snow, covering his head from the blows as the women herded him into the street. Fred Graves was greeted by the car lights and the sound of car horns. The residents of the project were awakened by the light and noise and appeared on their front porches, wrapped in blankets and coats. The women chased the naked man through the housing project with the might of their rising sticks. As he ran down the street, each family came out to look at their tribal council representative. It was December of 1995. A young woman cried in her bathroom and was comforted by an older friend. As Georgette helped the girl into her clothes, she whispered, "Shh." Just as if she was calming a baby. "It's okay, my girl. It's not your fault. It's okay. We will take care of you." Finally dressed, the girl sobbed again, and once more, Georgette drew her close.
"We'll get you that quick."
The Women's Warrior Society had had its second war party. The voice in Ojibwe comes from an audio found in the Ojibwe dictionary. Her name is Jerry Howard in Ojibwe, Ningabi Anuk, and she's from Leech Lake. Thank you so much for this resource. Well, I hope you enjoyed the story. The story is part of a workshop I have written on nonviolent struggle. So if you want to find it, it's on mujerpalabra.net, clases y talleres. That's all. Have a nice day.